Nest and Fonseca. It's a privilege to be here, and I'm very happy to be here at your first oral argument of the year. I'm representing the appellants Jaime and Sylvia Lopez, and we're appealing a number of grounds based upon rulings of the court in the district court. It's a suit for damages against, it's state and national, but in all the briefing it's called SNIC and Wellington Risk Insurance Agency. The four major errors that we're complaining of are the error in granting a complete and total motion for summary judgment, an error in overruling the appellant's objections to the summary judgment evidence of the appellee, the error in granting the defendant's objections to their evidence, and the error in awarding appellate attorney's fees, which were unconditional to SNIC and Wellington. My clients are individuals that live here in Edinburg, Texas, and have for a number of years. It's undisputed that they had a residential homeowners policy that was in effect between June 15 of 18 and June 15 of 19. And in September of 18, they had a sudden and unexpected water leak and mold. They had damage to the home's sheetrock, drywall, fixtures, studs, ceiling, and flooring. It caused health problems in Mr. Lopez, for which we're not suing at this time. It's not an issue before the court. He had medical care and finally surgical intervention. But this was about, all of a sudden they noticed there was water leaking from the ceiling in the master bedroom, started to try to determine what was the problem, and contacted the insurance company, and they told them two things on the 10th of September, that they might require an on-site inspection.
And did they do an inspection?
Well, if you want to call what Jordan Quiroz did, and also there was a group called Water Detect Masters or something of that nature. But there was someone who came to the house, and they also said the other requirement was that they provide a sworn proof of loss. But they sent out an agent of the homeowner's insurance company who told, this is Jordan Quiroz, who told Mr. Lopez, the appellant, that this claim will not be denied or accepted. He used both words. It will not be accepted or denied until you provide a sworn proof of loss.
And was that later memorialized in a letter to them?
Well, more or less in the letter of the 14th of September. But in the letter of the 14th, it does not say that, but they said in the letter of the 14th, here, we're providing you with $511. And they also said, we believe that part of your claim is not covered because it's due to maintenance issues. No idea what those maintenance issues are. No idea how they came up with $511.
Appellees, they say that there was actually two claims made, that one was denied and one was paid. So can you tell me what the difference is between those two claims?
That, yes, one of them related to a bathtub that they determined was leaking. And they said with the bathtub claim, we're just denying it because that's not a sudden and unexpected loss. But with regard to the water coming into the pipes and things that were causing the leak into the master bedroom ceiling, they said, we're going to pay you $511. They determined that the entire claim was worth $1,700. They said, you have a $1,200 deductible, so here's your $500. But no explanation of how they decided that he should get $500.
But is that the letter that was sent to them that said, if you disagree, you need to provide a proof of loss?
No, sir. The original letter was the one that said either way that you need to provide a proof of loss. And that's part of our argument, that if they said we can't accept or deny your claim until we get a proof of loss, well, they said he had 91 days to do that. But how could he know that there's two separate claims? How does an insured know that his bathtub claim is different than his water pipe claim? I mean, this is what, and that there's a maintenance issue. Doesn't tell him what the maintenance issue is. So it's very, very ambiguous from the standpoint of the insured. But then finally, when they filed the proof of loss, thinking that as soon as they filed the proof of loss, that there would be a claims file that would be discussed, they didn't know that the $511 was not negotiable.
But the proof of loss was filed February 3rd, 2021, correct?
That's correct. And that it was the same
877 days later.
I agree, but the question is, all of the ambiguities that are contained within this does not tell an insured what they need to do. Because if you take a look, there's another ambiguity or an And of course, the court knows that all ambiguities are construed against the insurance company. So they say in one place, we've got a contractual limitation that's going to be 2 years, but the state law says that you can't have a contractual limitation that could result in a less than 2 year period because it's unconstitutional.
And that all hinges on your argument about what the term complied with means. And I'd really like to know what your opinion of what complied with, I think that's the term that's used in the insurance contract, that everything has to be complied with first. And that's what gets us to possibly a statute of limitations that's shorter than 2 years.
Absolutely, because if they hypothetically denied a claim on the day that it was made, and then the person makes their claim within 3-4 months, it could be possible that they have less than 2 years of a statute of limitations. But the most important part of that particular ambiguity is the fact that the endorsement doesn't mention statute of limitations.
But does it need to say that? Is there a requirement that in the endorsement it says statute of limitations?
Well,
doesn't the bring a suit within 2 years, isn't that the same exact thing as statute of limitations?
To an insured who's uneducated, who's not a lawyer, I don't think it's the same thing. But you go back to the issue that the court granted a complete and total motion for summary judgment, and two of these claims undisputedly are not time barred, and that would be a breach of contract claim and a fraud claim. Under the insurance code and under the code of Civil Practice and Remedies Code, those two claims are 4-year claims. So even if they waited 850 days, they are still within a 4-year statute of limitations from the time of loss and from the time of the denial of the claim. And of course, we contend that the denial of the claim did not happen until February 21, when Ms. Ellsworth wrote a letter and said, this claim file is closed. You did not meet the statute of limitations. That is the first time that anyone mentions statute of limitations to the insured. So if there's a possibility of a 2-year statute, which they think they have by contract, but then the question is that an unconstitutional provision because it could result.
But appellees in their brief cite other cases from other jurisdictions that have very similar language in theirs, and they've held those to be unambiguous.
It's my
position. Is there a reason why we shouldn't do that?
In our briefing, we've pointed out cases to you that indicate that that's not specific enough because an insured does not know and an ambiguity is construed against the insurance company. And don't forget that our position is that the two sentences, sentence number one and sentence number two, are in conflict with each other if they are interpreted from the standpoint of the insured. Our insured gave an affidavit saying what he understood and what he believed.
So
that is some evidence.
You saying then that, and I went through the affidavit, but I don't remember everything that was in it, that all an insured needs to do is say, I haven't complied with the policy, therefore the second part of this provision doesn't kick in until I've complied. And so my question is, what does complied mean?
Well,
pay your premiums?
The plain language says, you gave me a letter saying I've got to do X, and I hadn't done X until now. So I didn't comply with the policy, so that sentence number two is in conflict. But there's also...
But didn't the policy also have another provision that says, look, if we're in disagreement, then you need to file suit so that you don't... miss the statute of limitations? Something to that effect?
I don't recall the mention of the statute of limitations, but don't forget that the law construes everything in favor of Lopez and says that if it's not fatally inconsistent and not void, the statute of limitations begins to run on February 5 of 21, because that's the date of the Ellsworth letter that made it unequivocal. Hey, we've denied this claim and it's already closed. So the insured's position is that the statute of limitations began to run on February the 5th of 21. If they want to make that endorsement specific, they can say it's date of loss, or it's 2 years, or it's 91 days, whatever it is. But there are at least four possibilities of how that could be construed.
But how is the September 24 letter not unequivocal?
Well, because they don't say what the maintenance is. They don't give the insured any information about why part of the claim is denied. And I found another ambiguity. It says the policy says that you have to have a suit filed within 91 days after we request a proof of loss. There is no letter out there that says, hey, by the way, we don't have a proof of loss. We need your proof of loss. All they gave them was an endorsement buried into an adhesion contract. They didn't give them a letter that says, we're requesting of you, Mr. Lopez, that you file a proof of loss.
You can take that up in your rebuttal. Your time is up.
Thank you, Judge.
The statute of limitations runs from the date that the claim is accepted or rejected, not when plaintiffs decide that they're going to comply with a moot policy provision. And two, despite the language that there no suit can be brought until the policy provisions have been complied with, when the court reads the policy as a whole.
What does that mean to you? Because I think there's a lot of talk in the briefs about, especially from the appellant's side, about complied with. What does that mean? And what burden does that put on the appellants to comply with the insurance contract?
Right. So that first sentence means you need to perform your duties under the policy. There are certain things that need to happen before.
Pay your premium,
notify the insurance company of your loss, cooperate with the insurance company in their investigation, so that way they can make an informed decision and provide benefits under that policy. That is the requirement that the insureds must cooperate with the insurance company in order to have a valid cause of action. That first sentence does not have a time, is not a statement on the statute of limitations itself. It's explaining what the insured must do in order to bring a suit. But despite that, they still have a specific time limit, 2 years from when the claim is accepted or rejected to
and
file
even
suit.
Even if the appellants had not complied with in the insured's eyes, they could still file suit, but then that would be a question for the trial court to determine whether they could move forward because they weren't doing their part of the contract.
That's exactly correct. If defendants or appellees provided some exhibits to the court, if the court would turn to tab 2 of those exhibits, you'll see the policy language that says that if the insured files suit before they've complied with all of their policy provisions, then the case must be abated until the policy provisions have been complied with. And there are several Texas cases out there that analyze this language or language similar, that no suit can be brought until the statute, no suit can be brought until the policy provisions have been complied with, to mean that the insured has suspended its right to recover under the policy, but it doesn't trigger the statute of limitations. So what that means in reality is, if the insured prematurely files suit, let's say they don't notify the carrier of their disagreement with the claim determination, and they file suit anyway, the insured can elect to abate that case. And it can say, this case cannot move forward. We're not going to go through discovery. We're not going to go through litigation until they have complied with the policy provisions, until they have informed the insurance company, what is your dispute with our claim determination? And that's what that language means. And it's pretty widely accepted across Texas courts that if the suit is filed prematurely, you abate the case. You don't dismiss the case. It's not barred because it's not barred in total.
If we determine that the appellants didn't file suit within the 2-year statute of limitations, if that's what we determine, whether it's 2 or 4, then need we address the other sub issues that the appellants have, the fraud claims? Are they separate? Can we, or do we need to separate those out from the contract claims? I know that the summary judgment, there was no findings within that summary judgment. It just looked like it was a, mm-hmm. a blanket grant and deny on either side. So would we have to separate those causes of action?
For the fraud claims are subject to a 4-year statute of limitations, but there are brief outlines, very distinct reasons why summary judgment is proper on those claims as well. There is a separate breach of contract claim for failure to renew the policy, and again, there are distinct reasons why that breach of contract claim fails, namely that there is no requirement under Texas law to renew a policy. Insurance companies can refuse to renew policies so long as they provide written notice within 30 days of the policy's expiration. Here, notice was sent more than 30 days before the insurance policy was set to expire, and they don't dispute that notice was timely mailed. The only requirement that appellees are required to show is that notice of the non-renewal was timely mailed. Here it was. I believe appellants argue that they didn't receive the notice, that they found out over the phone, but that's not something that would preclude an insurance company from not renewing a policy. On top of that, they are required to, if the notice was not timely sent, then it's on the insured to request renewal of the policy and pay the premiums. Neither one of those were done in this situation. So in short, there are several different claims here. Yes, I think the main one being the breach of contract claim for benefits due under the policy, that one and the 542 claims fall with the statute of limitations.
So, and I'm not sure you can explain this because you are representing the appellees, but can you explain or possibly explain why there's some confusion on the appellant's part about the two different claims? I don't see anything in the appellant's brief about there being two separate claims. And in your brief, you mentioned one was paid, one was denied, but there seems to be confusion about some actual documentation about whether there was one or two different claims.
Right. The documentation and the record, the record shows that two different claims were filed. One claim was filed on September 7th, 2018. And then a second claim was filed on September 11th, 2018. These two claims were assigned different claim numbers. They were reported to the insurance company on separate days. The insurance company has documentation for two separate claims for two different parts of the insured's home and for two distinct damages. I can't explain why the appellants would be confused by that, other than they happened so relatively close in time. But the documentation that was sent to the appellant clearly states different dates of losses for each claim and a different claim number. And one of the things that I do want to address that was brought up was that the September 24th letter, which was a claim determination letter, how are the appellants supposed to know that their claim was denied or that it was insufficient because it did not outline a specific reason? That's simply not true. If you look at the record and you look at those claim determinations, it is outlined in there why their claim is being denied. The first claim was denied because it was not a result of a covered loss. It was found that the caulking around the tub had deteriorated and was allowing water to seep into the back walls. The second claim, which was for the water line, which was the one that was accepted and paid, was covered in part because it was the result of sudden and unexpected water leaks. So,
now, when you say it was paid, I know that the record indicates that $500-something was sent to the appellants. I'm guessing they did not accept that money. I mean, they didn't take that money and deposit it in the bank.
That I'm not sure. That's not in the record.
Okay.
But payment was issued to them.
Payment was tendered. We don't know whether it was cashed.
Exactly. Okay. Payment was tendered to them. Now, at that point, once they received that claim determination, and again, that's for a separate claim determination, that claim determination was actually made on October 3rd, 2018, and it explained to them, although we haven't received your proof of loss, we have determined that you are entitled to coverage and a payment. And it explained that you are going to receive payment for the actual damage caused by the water, and that the repairs to the busted water line were not covered under the policy because their policy didn't cover actual repairs to plumbing. So that to say that there was no explanation, that the insureds were completely in the dark about what they, you know, what was happening with their claims and what their rights were and what their obligations were once they got those claim determinations is completely disingenuous. They had all the information back in September and October of 2018. If they disagreed with the claim determinations, it was their obligation to notify the insurance company of their disagreements or file suit within 2 years, or not within 2 years, but file suit 2 years following the claims being accepted or rejected. If you look at the record, you're gonna see that.
So those 2 years would have started on the date they received the letter tendering the $500 and something, and or the date that you denied coverage for the bathtub.
Right, their statute of limitations would begin to run.
That's your contention. That's when the statute of limitations runs, the 2 years that they contractually agreed to.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And plaintiff's argument regarding the proof of loss, that the proof of loss triggers the statute of limitations, is incorrect. They are saying that, well, we never provided a proof of loss, so the statute of limitations could never start to run because we never complied with the policy. Plaintiffs omit the fact that they had 91 days from the day it was requested to submit that proof of loss. They never did it. They submitted it 877 days after it was requested, and then that same day filed suit. If they truly believe that this proof of loss was necessary in order for the insurance company to accept or reject the claim, why did they file suit 3 hours after submitting that claim the proof of loss to the insurance company? They never gave the insurance company an opportunity to respond to that proof of loss. They never gave the insurance company, as they contend, an opportunity to accept or deny the claim. But it really doesn't matter at the end of the day, because it is undeniable that those claim determinations were made back in 2018. They clearly say your claim has been accepted in part, and the other one said your claim is being denied. That is when the statute of limitations ran in this case. And the fact that the insureds misunderstood the policy or misunderstood what their rights and obligations were under the policy does not create an ambiguity. When the policy is read as a whole, as this court's required to do, it is clear that they had 2 years from the claim determination. The first sentence that plaintiffs contend is ambiguous about all the policy provisions must be complied with does not trigger the statute of limitations. And to the extent that they are arguing that it creates a limitations of less than 2 years, it doesn't. When you look at the case law that they have cited to this court, those policies are completely different. None of those cases say that those policies are void because there is a clause in there that says you must complete all the policy provisions and file suit within 2 years. That's not why those cases found that policy was void. Those cases found that those policies were void because those policies hinged the statute of limitations from the date of loss. And when you hinge the statute of limitations from a date that precedes the actual accrual of a cause of action, you're always going to end up in a situation where you have less than 2 years to file suit. You know, let's take a simple example of if there is a hailstorm on January 1st, damages your home. You come home from vacation on January 3rd, notice the damage, call the insurance company. If your policy says you have to file suit within 2 years of the date of loss, that's impossible. You didn't even know that your home was damaged on the date of loss. But here we have 2 years from the claim determination. And that is when your cause of action accrues in a first party case. And so that allows insureds 2 years to file suit.
What was the 91 days, the letter that gave them 91 days to submit the proof of loss? What was the date of that?
I believe it was September 10th, I want to say. Let's see. Yes, September 10th, 2018 is when they got that letter. And in that letter, I pulled part of it in tab four of the exhibits. It says, within 91 days after the loss, provide us a signed sworn proof of loss.
Hey, I do want to get into something else because it's something, and it's actually your cross appeal on, it's their contention on the appellate attorney's fees. Appellate attorney's fees were awarded in this case. And I'm curious how we should deal with those, because when attorney's fees are awarded for whatever reason in the trial court, with any fee-shifting statute that we might have, with Romos and its predecessor, I think, was it Lodestar, I think, which detailed all of the different things you have to say in your when you prove up your attorney's fees. Who's doing the work, how much time, the novelty of the work that you're doing, all those different things to prove up your attorney's fees. That's easier to do at trial because you finished a trial and you can present it to the judge and the judge can say yay or nay on some of them. You have the opportunity to be cross-examined. But with contingent appellate fees, it's a little more tricky. And I'm wondering, and I don't like the idea, but I'm wondering if the only way, if you prevail on appeal and the judge has awarded you appellate fees on appeal, but you've not yet done the work, only now after the appeal is done and actually after the opinion is written, and we've had the opportunity before to remand it to the trial court to determine how much, in fact, or how much attorney's fees should be awarded, which may be different if you apply Romos and its predecessors. So my question is that really good use of the judiciary or the courts to send it back every time for a determination of appellate fees?
So in this case, the trial court awarded a specific amount for the appellate attorney's fees, based on the affidavit of Thomas Nye, and then in conjunction with my affidavit discussing the details of the work that went on in the trial court level. And Mr. Nye's affidavit outlines how many hours it's estimated to take to work on the appeal all the way through the Supreme Court and oral argument at the Supreme Court. It's based on the hourly rates of the partners and the associates and the paralegals within his firm. And appellate attorney's fees are amorphous in a sense, similar to future medical. You only get one, litigants only get one bite at the apple to say, this is what my future medical is going to be based on this expert testimony. And at that point, you can only do so much to get as close as possible to the reasonable and necessary attorney's fees. And here, Mr. Nye provided his expertise on how much an appeal of this caliber would cost all the way through the Texas Supreme Court.
So are you saying that if you do prevail, that the matter should not be sent back, shouldn't be remanded to the trial court for a determination on those fees?
Correct, because the trial court already awarded specific amounts for the attorney's fees in the final summary judgment order.
And what about the fees that, on your appeal? You provided your time log and your affidavit after the hearing took place in the trial court and provided a letter to the court on December 11th, and then the court ruled on that day without giving the other side an opportunity to look at those at the time, to look at whether they're reasonable or necessary. There was no argument, no discussion about that.
With respect to the trial attorney's fees, though, plaintiffs didn't object to striking our affidavit at the hearing, so we would contend that they waived them. Our brief also cites cases that say that the court can consider trial attorney's fees and evidence presented to it the day of the hearing, so long as that evidence is in the record before an actual ruling has been made.
What about the notice? If the other side doesn't even have notice of what those fees are, how are they supposed to object?
The objection should have come at the summary judgment hearing when they were presented to the trial court. They were filed that same day, but they were also presented to the trial court at that hearing and to opposing counsel at that hearing.
And he awarded zero trial fees, didn't he?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
He did not make me clairvoyant. And Judge Vasquez holds hearings at 8 a.m., and their affidavit on attorney's fees was filed at 11. So there could be no way that we would have known that they were going to be seeking appellate attorney's fees in the manner that they did, with an amorphous amount that they provided to the judge 3 hours after he already ruled. Because Judge Vasquez ruled that he was throwing the whole case out. And it doesn't matter what the amount is, because the Yowell case and the Cessna aircraft case, Yowell being a Texas Supreme Court case and Cessna being a Dallas case, both say that you have to provide opinion testimony and that it must be reversed if there is no such thing, and that you cannot issue an unconditional award of attorney's fees, period. That's what Cessna aircraft says. It has to be conditional upon our failing in our appeal. So that part must be stricken. It must be rendered that is not an appropriate ruling. And if you look at the Cessna aircraft case, it makes it very clear.
Well, let me ask you, if hypothetically, if they prevail on all counts on the appeal, are they entitled to the appellate fees that were awarded by the trial court?
No, because they did not meet the standards that are required under Wormuth and the others of giving an affidavit with a billing statement with the number of hours, at least what would be expected as prior to the hearing, so that we could file objections to that. The court
took it. At this level, should they be stricken, or should they be sent back to the trial court?
It's my opinion they should be stricken, because they didn't even make a good faith effort. In the record, you can see where Ms. Guerrero said, the judge said, do you have an affidavit on file for your attorney's fees? And she said, I don't think I have such a thing on file. So clearly, at the time of the hearing, there was nothing on file. But procedurally, everything about this summary judgment was handled improperly, it's our position, because the court granted the summary judgment on an affirmative defense that was not pleaded. And we have cited cases that say you cannot grant a summary judgment on an affirmative defense unless there is proof offered, and there was no proof offered. Not only that, it's not pleaded. And so the cases that we've cited, which is Ballandron and Forbaugh, both say that you can't grant a summary judgment based on an affirmative defense that's not pleaded. And so we also talked about the fact that it's briefed extensively, the fact that until the Ellsworth letter came out and said we're done, that was the triggering event. The defendants said that their endorsement was in accordance with 2301 of the insurance code. But 2301 of the insurance code says it only applies to insurers issuing policies in a catastrophe zone, which Hidalgo County is not. So there's a question about whether or not that endorsement that they're relying on even applies to this case. Now, they do it a footnote in their brief that says, oh, well, insurance commissioner says we're going to apply this to other counties. Well, that's not the legislature. That's not the law. That was something that the insurance commissioner decided to add. So the issue is going back to the policy provision under 2301 that says unequivocally no suit or action can be brought unless the policy provisions have been complied with. Now, she says in her last argument, she says, well, they had a duty to cooperate. Our people let Jordan Quiros in their house. Our people let the leak detectors in the house. Our people did everything they could. Now,
well,
they say,
I don't think they're saying that they believe that the policy wasn't complied with. I think that they just think that they gave you their acceptance and denial on a certain date, and 2 years passed.
What I was referring to is the fact that Ms. Guerrero mentioned what their duty was. And clearly, when she mentioned what their duties were, our people complied. Our people were confused, apparently, about when they had to provide a proof of loss. But don't forget that when the original person went out there, the adjuster, he told them, oh, this is a water damage claim and it's covered. That was a misrepresentation.
But in fact, wasn't it covered? Didn't they offer tender $580?
Well, that's the thing, that they tried to split it up between some things that they felt were covered and some that they sloughed off in the trash can as maintenance, but they didn't explain why in the world they were dismissing a large part of their claim, because our client, in reliance on the statement of the first person who went that said this is a covered loss, went and incurred $23,000 in contractor fees to get it fixed. Well, why is that unreasonable? He relied on a misrepresentation of an agent of the company who said, this is a covered loss, it's going to be paid for. If they had paid...
Did he tell them how much they were going to pay?
I'm sorry?
Did he tell them how much they were going to
pay? Well, no, that wasn't his job, but he did tell them that it was going to be paid. So we would contend that that was a misrepresentation made on behalf of the appellees, and the court granted the affirmative defense without them making their burden of proof on the affirmative defense of statute of limitations. You'll notice that was not pleaded, and their proof of their attorney's fees also did not meet the standards. So the judge went too far in granting an affirmative defense, a summary judgment on an affirmative defense without there being proof, because the burden shifts once we offer evidence on everyone. And that also brings up the issue of the court striking our expert's affidavit. Mrs. Mount filed an affidavit, and she filed a supplemental affidavit in which she said, I've done first party claims, I have defended insurance companies, I worked for Longcar, I did plaintiff's work, I've done all of this stuff. And the test is whether or not she has an opinion that's based on her expertise and her experience. Well, if you look at the record, Judge Vasquez struck her affidavit not because it was conclusory, not because she didn't have a basis for her objections, which is what the appellees seem to want to get you to believe, because they brief about the fact that, oh, you can't do that, it's conclusory. They didn't make that objection to the affidavit. But what Judge Vasquez struck the affidavit on was she's not qualified. Well, that, we would submit, is a ridiculous conclusion when you have a lady who's practiced many, many years, has worked on both sides of the docket and handled first-party claims. So you strike her affidavit, and then the question is, were they justified? Was the misrepresentation that the claim was not accepted or denied? In Lopez thought it wasn't going to be denied or accepted until the proof of loss claim, because it says no suit or action can be brought until the policy has been complied with. And then the second misrepresentation was, okay, it's going to be paid. That's a fraud claim, because they sent a representative out there who made a statement that they relied on and contracted with a contractor based upon that statement. And then we also have a breach of their failure to renew the policy. That hasn't come up today, but they have to give a 30-day notice. It's basically a 31-day notice. They say they gave them 37 days from the time that they mailed it. Jaime Lopez provided an affidavit saying, I never got a notice of non-renewal.
Aren't they only required to prove that they sent it?
It's not clear. It's not clear. When he comes back and affirmatively says, I never got the notice, they never send him a bill. They say, well, he didn't pay a premium. How many of us pay bills when we're not receiving a premium, whether it's paper or electronic? We don't normally go pay bills unless we're given a notice.
Isn't that his responsibility to make sure that he has insurance and that he makes sure that the bill is paid?
It's interesting that you ask that, because when there's a mortgage on the property, usually the lender asks for proof of insurance, but nobody asked him for proof of insurance, and he assumed that it was being automatically renewed because he didn't get a notice they were denying it. But don't forget that there's a declaratory judgment in here as well that the judge denied. The declaratory judgment was covered under the policy, and the policy premium was in effect between 18 and 19, which I stated at the beginning. He had insurance. There's no question about that. He had insurance with these people, and he expected that they were going to take care of him, and they did not, and he believes that he did his part. So we have an error in dismissing the fraud claim, but also an error in dismissing the breach of contract claim. clearly the judgment cannot stand on the unconditional appellate fees. It is our position that because procedurally we're here on a summary judgment, we're not after a trial. This isn't a sufficiency of the evidence claim. This is summary judgment. We didn't get a chance to try our case because he granted a complete and total summary judgment on an affirmative defense that was not pleaded. And there's an ambiguity in the contract which has to be construed in favor of the insured. So for all those reasons, we believe that the court must reverse and remand with the exception of the attorney's fees, which should be rendered against the appellees. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Clance. Good to see you. Good to see you, Ms. Guerrero.